You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koutou katoa, ko Caden Tokawingawa, no mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. My name is Caden, I'm your host for today and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by Tuesday Wire host Sarah and producer Sanat. Efa Akane coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone about the war on Gaza, Labour MP Camilla Balich's pay secrecy bill, and the increase in KiwiSaver hardship withdrawals. For International Desk, I spoke to Ralph Hall, advisor at the Electoral Reform Society in the United Kingdom, about the significant electoral reform in the UK. News and Editorial Director Joel spoke to the New Zealand Principals Federation's Blair Dravitsky on the government stopping the construction of open plan classrooms. Sarah, what have you got for us today?
For this week's City Counselling, I spoke with Councillor Shane Henderson about the liquidation of Council Chief of Staff's business, calls for stronger powers to respond to roaming dogs, and Auckland's local alcohol policy.
Hea ha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wire mai rāne. Give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka awa e wari wari e ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō. He pakehere roki roki mārunga i te pai. Tuku tuku o Irirangi Pōhō. Mi haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309 3879. Now let's get into the show.
Now it's time for our weekly catch up with the Labour Party's Carmel Cipollone.
Earlier this week, New Zealand Parliament voted to support a joint statement with the 27 other countries calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. However, the opposition parties say it doesn't go far enough and more action is needed from New Zealand to condemn Israel's actions in Gaza. On Wednesday, Labour MP Camilla Balich's bill titled the Employment Relations Employee Remuneration Disclosure Amendment Bill passed its second reading. The bill, also known as the Pay Secrecy Law, would make pay secrecy clauses in workers' contracts that prevent them from discussing their salaries with colleagues unenforceable. The bill was supported by all opposition parties, as well as the National Party, through second reading. And 50,000 people have made withdrawals from the KiwiSaver for the reason of financial hardship this year. This is compared to 18,000 5 years ago. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I asked Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone about all of these topics. I started by asking if New Zealand should join South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice.
Our point strongly on the international stage that, you know, we expect an immediate and permanent ceasefire, that there needs to be full and unhindered humanitarian access, there needs to be the recognition of the state of Palestine, and accountability for those obstructing or politicising aid delivery.
Why has New Zealand been so slow in condemning what's happening in Gaza, especially when we were rightfully so fast to condemn this in Ukraine?
I think it just shows a lack of leadership from this government. I have to say that, you know, historically, in terms of New Zealand having its own independent forest policy and standing up for what is right on the international stage, it hasn't been national-led governments that have done that. And sadly, what we're seeing is that lack of moral courage that we expect from New Zealand governments under the leadership of Chris Luxon.
Te Pāti Māori has called for the Israeli ambassador to be expelled. Given the current context of Israel denying humanitarian aid, do you support this?
Look, I think that there's a case to be made either way. There's also the case to be made that you want to be able to continue to have those conversations to strongly get the points across that I made earlier. And so there is a case to be made either way.
Overall, if you're re-elected next year, will there be a substantial shift in New Zealand's foreign policy stance towards Israel-Palestine?
You can expect that we would act at pace, that we would be much stronger condemning the actions that are taking place. I think you can expect that we would move quickly on things that the government haven't moved on. Our track record shows that when situations like this have arisen, we've been very fast to move on things like humanitarian visas. And so I think that you can expect a stronger voice, a stronger government, and much more deliberate action.
Why is the PayTalk Protection Bill important to the Labor Party?
It's not just important to the Labor Party. I was sitting around the table with women leaders from the construction sector last week, and they were saying that this is really important, that it's common practice in their sector, that they would sign away the right to be able to share what they are getting paid. It means there's no transparency in the workplace. And it means that you can't have transparency over things like the gender pay gap and whether or not women are being paid to the same extent as their male counterparts. And so it's not just Labor that's pushing on this. There are a lot of sectors out there that know that this is the right thing to do.
Is this discussion relevant in the context of the government scrapping pay equity claims?
Yeah, it is relevant because what we will see as a result of the government scrapping the pay equity claims is that the gender pay gap will continue to grow under the watch of a national-led government. And if we have secrecy of pay, where people can't even openly talk about what they're being paid, then you can expect that things won't improve either. So it all is all about collectively increasing the incomes of women so that they're on par with their male counterparts across the country. That only seems fair. And it's not just good for women, it's good for their children, their whānau as well.
Are you confident this bill will pass third reading?
It's certainly looking like it will, I think. So, well done to Camilla Balich.
Why do you think KiwiSaver hardship withdrawals are going up?
They're going up because New Zealanders are struggling so much with the cost of living at the moment. The government, before they got in on the campaign trail, were promising relief to these families. And instead, we've seen their financial situations go backwards and the cost of living continue to skyrocket. It's a real worry because it means that not only are they struggling now, but when they go into retirement, they're going to have a reduced amount of money in their KiwiSaver savings to support them during those retirement years to be able to get by and pay for their everyday needs. So not only do we have a short-term problem with the cost of living and people's ability to be able to put food on the table and pay for the roof over their head. But we've got a longer-term issue looming with the number of New Zealanders who are having to access their KiwiSaver due to hardship.
The dramatic rise in withdrawals began in 2023. Does this mean it's partially Labor's fault that this is happening?
Oh, we have, been very open and transparent about what was happening in 2023, and I think that everyone saw it. You know, on the globally, what we were seeing was inflation skyrocketing off the back of COVID and because of things like the wars that were occurring and then increased fuel prices and other things as a result of that. The bite started to be felt then. That's very true. The thing is that many other countries are well on their way to recovery now. And yet we are in a country where we're still experiencing recession, where inflation is still high, where incomes are low, and New Zealanders are struggling. Now, that can't be put on the previous Labor government. That's a responsibility of this current government and in many ways a direct result of the policy choices that they have made.
The situation is even worse for those who are struggling who do not have KiwiSaver, as they do not have this fallback. What is your response to people in this situation?
It's hard to respond to people that are in that situation because their reality is so difficult right now. There are many New Zealanders that are struggling to find work because unemployment's so high and the labour market is tight. But we know that they are trying. We know that they are doing everything that they can to be able to provide for themselves and for their families. Sadly, we've got a government who, instead of acknowledging the hardship that is out there, is basically putting the boot in to anyone who is in this predicament through no fault of their own.
Apologies once again for that glitch before the interview. That was Labour Deputy Leader Carmel Cipollone on the war on Gaza, the Pay Talk Protection Bill, and the rise in KiwiSaver hardship withdrawals.
That was our weekly chat with the Labour Party.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
This week, Auckland Council is facing scrutiny as Council Chief Executive Phil Wilson investigates the liquidation of a company owned by Chief of Staff Jaswant Singh. His property company, which called in for liquidation in June, has no assets and owes sole creditor Inland Revenue just under $560,000. In other news, Auckland Council is reinvigorating calls for stronger powers under the Dog Control Act, as community leaders report a crisis of abandoned and roaming dogs across Auckland. Both the local council and community organisations like SPCA are urging the central government to take action and support on-the-ground efforts with legislative change. As well, a recent survey has found that local alcohol policy changes enacted at the end of 2024 have had a positive impact in Auckland. But one community advocate believes the council should not be complacent about improving policies to make the community safer against the harms of alcohol. I spoke with Shane Henderson about all of these topics, starting with Singh's company liquidation. I wanted to get started with this story this week about mayoral executive Jaz Singh, who owns a property company in liquidation owing $560,000 to Inland Revenue. The issue is currently being investigated by council executives. In your view, is there a level of responsibility or accountability that ought to be placed on Mayor Wayne Brown with relation to this incident?
No, well, the mayor has been really clear that he hadn't actually heard of that investment company or received any advice about this at all. It's something that, you know, employees will do in their own personal time and have their own personal affairs. So, no, look, I don't think it has anything to do, frankly, with Mayor Brown or actually with the council. I think it's sort of personal matter for Jazz to handle.
What are your thoughts on the assertion by Councillor Karen Leone that that this case demonstrates that current leadership of Auckland Council is financially irresponsible?
Yes, as politely as I can, I would challenge that. Look, in terms of how staff conduct their private affairs and their dealings, that's not for politicians to comment on, frankly. I don't think it's any of my business, and it doesn't reflect on the public finances at all. It's something that, you know, we all have different personal finances and personal things going on in our lives. You know, and I have a degree of empathy with, you know, some of the situation must be very tough, right? And people have friends and families and all this kind of stuff. So, look, it's not for me to comment on staff and what they're doing. So, look, I would sort of politely push back on that.
I'll let that go in terms of I'm sure they're investigating that and they'll work through all those issues. I'll move on to my next topic. Can you explain what some of Auckland Council's proposed changes are for the Dog Control Act?
Yes, so Auckland Council's calling on the government to sort of allow us to have stronger powers under the Dog Control Act. And I think that's a really fantastic move. I actually visited the Henderson de-sexing unit on the concourse, and they're doing a fantastic job. And look, council's invested $5.9 million additional funding to support animal management because there's huge issues out there with council's abilities to detain dogs following an attack. And there's legislative things that need to be changed so that we actually have more powers to detain dogs. For example, serious dog attacks a lot of them happen in the family home, especially when we're involving children, and go unreported to the council. So if we had the ability to intervene and put measures in place to prevent attacks through things like mandatory reporting, that'd be a fantastic idea. And so I'd really support our efforts there, and I'd urge the government to help us out so that we can keep our community safe.
You've mentioned a little bit here, but in public discussion, I've seen that there's a bit of confusion about where exactly the responsibility lies in terms of addressing this issue and ensuring that dogs are, that the community is safe with roaming dogs or with dogs in general. I just wanted to ask, in your view, what do you think is the council's role as opposed to the role of dog owners themselves and community organisations to address this issue?
Yeah, totally. Councils actually work with community organisations on this. To, you know, pick up roaming dogs, to investigate attacks as best we can and stuff. But we need measures such as fencing requirements for dog owners. That's something that we could look at. Allowing councils to set our own desexing policies and actually to improve our ability to detain dogs, like I said earlier. Those are things that we don't have because, goodness, the Dog Control Act is from 1996, so we've got to be careful with it because it's a bit of an antique, right? There's nearly 30 years there. We could update that and improve council's ability to sort of fix this issue because it is a growing issue year on year. So urging the government to help us out.
Finally, my last topic is about Auckland's local alcohol policy. It's been about 6 months since changes were made to this policy. What effect do you think these have had for the community?
Yeah, look, it's been a roaring success, frankly. There was an online survey that Alcohol Health Watch ran, and Auckland has reported that their neighbourhoods were quieter, safer and cleaner since the policy came into effect. There's been fewer incidents of people getting hammered and causing trouble on the streets. Parks and reserves are tidier. That was always a big bugbear of ours as sort of local representatives. And actually, in terms of off-licenses as well, no breaches have been reported by off-license holders. So honestly, it's been a roaring success, and it's been really great. So look, that's the big news story, I think, is that a successful policy has really been enacted here and communities are responding really well to it.
Do you agree with the assertion made by Dr. Grant Hewison, a lawyer who works with Community Against Alcohol Harm, that the council should be seeking to review and update the local policy to address ongoing harms ahead of the end of the two-year freeze period in 2026?
Yeah, look, this is an awful answer because I'm kind of conflicted. So there's only so much I can do. I don't actually take part in the decisions around the local alcohol policies. But what I would say just generally is that, yeah, we should always be looking to review these policies to make sure that they work and look at any tweaks that are required and demanded by communities. So we need to be responsive as a council. So, you know, that would be my answer, I think.
Do you think that there's any more that Auckland Council should be doing to ensure that local policy around alcohol consumption remains beneficial for Auckland's population, balancing community safety and just freedom and lack of restriction, I suppose?
Yeah, I think there is a balance there. I think you're exactly right because things like alcohol, I suppose, have an economic development and economic activity element to this. But we need to make sure, for example, that public education is always used, and council, I think, will always have a role to play in that so that harmful behaviours are not exhibited, that everybody is staying safe, and that, you know, we're attacking things like the road tolls and drink driving. Those are things that we all have a responsibility to play to address those negative behaviours. So, yeah, it is a bit more of a complicated picture, but definitely things that council can do to keep our community safe and keep them informed about some of the dangers with some negative behaviour.
That was Shane Henderson on Chief of Staff Jaz Singh's property business liquidation, changes needed for the Dog Control Act, and Auckland's local alcohol policy.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat. Text in your thoughts 5395. This is The Field from Blood Orange.
And so They say that fashion is art, and you, lovely listeners, are the canvas.
That's right. We've been in the lab designing some sexy new merch for you to stay hot when it's cold and cool as hell when it's hot.
We've got new tees, hoodies, the classic BSA slogan, and a limited edition t-shirt of BFM's iconic weatherman, Rick Breeze.
So run, don't walk, to twotonesmerch.co.nz and get your grubby little mitts on the hottest new 95 BFM merch.
A shiny new web series featuring local artists performing two of their own songs and one Kiwi cover.
Hosted by legend Tuva O'Clifton, Season 1 features Phoebe Rings, Soft Bait, Emily Bateman, Jim Nothing, Babe Martin and Eliza.
B-Sides! New episode dropping every second Wednesday. Watch it now on the 95 BFM YouTube channel.
Of course, it is within this...
Do you have a pen?
What?
A pen. I forgot my laptop.
Look, you're going to have to speak up. What was it?
Nothing.
Shut
don't worry.
Up. Would you be quiet?
What? Honestly, so hard to hear over all this shushing. You people ought to be ashamed.
Shut
Some
up.
Of us actually give a hoot about Commerce 335.
Tune in to Ready, Steady, Learn as a motley crew of academics from the University of Auckland take us through a range of thought-provoking topics. Every Tuesday on 95 BFM Breakfast, thanks to the University of Auckland.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk are go.
The United Kingdom is passing significant electoral reforms as part of an effort to boost public trust in democracy. One of these reforms is to lower the voting age to 16 for all elections, aligning voting rights with Scotland and Wales that already have lowered their voting ages. The changes still require parliamentary approval, but this is unlikely to be a hurdle as Prime Minister Keir Starmer campaigned on these promises. The reforms also include expanding acceptable voter IDs, a new automated system to register to vote, and a tightening of rules surrounding political donations. For International Desk, I spoke to Ralph Hall, advisor for the Electoral Reform Society, about these changes. The Electoral Reform Society is an independent organisation in the United Kingdom that campaigns for democratic rights. I started by asking Hall to explain what the announcement in the UK means for the voting age.
Absolutely. So the government last week announced the elections strategy for the next the changes they're going to make before the next general election in the UK. And one of the key ones was confirming their manifesto commitment to lower the voting age from 18 to 16. And this will be in place before the probable 2029, maybe 2028 UK general election.
Has this been a long-standing discussion in the UK?
Absolutely. It has been quite a long-standing discussion and debate. It's something that the Labour Party have had in their manifestos for over a decade now. They've just been mainly in opposition. So now that they're finally in government, they are implementing something that Ed Miliband back in 2013, I think, announced and committed to. It was also something that the Liberal Democrats had as far back as 2001 in their manifesto. And there have been campaigns in civil society for this since at least 2003 when a Vote to 16 coalition was formed. So it has been a long debate in the UK, and that is now being progressed with this elections bill that will be coming up in the next few months and or year or so.
What is the Labour Party's reasoning for supporting this change?
The Labour Party, at least their stated reason, is that turnout has been low in the UK, and we've seen from countries that have had a lower voting age, such as Scotland, which is part of the UK, and Austria and other places, is that youth turnout actually increases when you lower the voting age, because people who are 16 and 17 vote at a higher rate than people who cast their first ballot when they're 18, 19, 20. And that pattern of voting then continues. They form more a lifelong habit of voting. And so the Labour Party is definitely framing this as positive for turnout. It's also positive for youth engagement. And they also talk about comparable ages, such as the fact that at 16 you can leave home, work full-time and join the army. So those are the sorts of arguments that the UK Labour Party are raising.
Has this been a popular decision? And if not, what has the opposition been?
I think it's something that has a lot of support amongst young people, but it is something that is debated and contested in the United Kingdom. You have people on both sides of the equation. I think the main opposition parties, the Conservative Party and Reform, have both come out against it, but there are a number of parties in Parliament, the Liberal Democrats, the Green Party, and others who are supportive of it. And so there is different views amongst different political parties on this issue.
Along with the voting age, the government announced several other electoral reforms. Could you touch a bit on what these are?
Absolutely. So the voting age was just one part of the election strategy that was announced last week. There's also going to be changes to the rules around voter ID. They're expanding the types of ID that can be used as part of that. They have voter ID in the UK. There is also going to be tougher laws on harassment or abuse of candidates and election workers. One thing that's quite interesting is that they are moving towards a system of automatic voter registration, so enabling the electoral roll to be automatically updated with data from, for example, driver's license or other interactions people have with government services. And so it means that it takes an administrative burden away from people to be constantly updating their details as they move or to enroll for the first time. This is actually something that is being discussed in New Zealand as well. And so it hasn't been reported much, but back in April, the government responded to the Justice and Electoral Committee in New Zealand to their inquiry into the 2023 New Zealand election. And they indicated that they're going to be in New Zealand passing a bill before the next general election that will enable automatic voter registration in New Zealand as well. Whether or not they'll also provide the Electoral Commission with the money to sort of actually do some of that automatic enrolment is a question mark. The Electoral Commission said they needed a lot more money to do this. There's also a big question over whether or not in New Zealand it will work to for new voters who, because if you are Māori, you can choose to be on the Māori roll or the general roll. And so automatically enrolling someone in that situation does raise some questions, and so they'll need to work through those. So it'll be interesting to see the bill that the government puts through in the coming months in New Zealand.
What is driving these other significant electoral reforms? I guess obviously in the UK, but also in New Zealand and maybe internationally.
Yeah, I think there's a real need to reflect on our democracies around the world and how to strengthen them and how to revitalize democracy. Here in the United Kingdom, there is a feeling that, you know, of that the government isn't working well for people, that people want to see a change from the status quo. And one important way of revitalizing trust and faith in democratic institutions is to do things like expand the franchise. Young people have a particularly negative view of the government, but if they have a direct say in elections, then what we've seen from examples in other countries where the voting age is lowered is that people do increase their satisfaction with government when they actually do have a say on the ballot and aren't disenfranchised.
That was Ralph Hall from the Electoral Reform Society in the UK on the recently announced changes to their democracy.
International Desk on 95 BFM.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree?
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. This is some New Order. Oh, and text in your thoughts, 5395.
We'll be right back.
around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Last week, Education Minister Erica Stanford announced that the construction of open-plan classrooms would be halted. The National Party had previously petitioned for the classroom design in 2011, with the idea of pushing for flexibility in the way students were taught and to accommodate a shift in how technology is used in educational spaces. However, the classroom design has received a mixture of responses. Some say the classroom design resulted in a noisy and distracting environment. Despite this, surveys by the Council for Educational Research showed that most teachers like open-plan classrooms, adding that students benefited from the classroom design. News and editorial director Joel spoke to Blair Dravitsky about the government's move regarding open-plan classrooms. Dravitsky is a spokesperson on the topic for the New Zealand Principals Federation, and Tumuaki, principal of Te Uru Tarata, Lemonwood Grove School in Rolleston.
For those who are unaware, what are open plan classrooms and how do they operate differently compared to the standard sort of classroom?
Yeah, so open plan describes the physical environment that came in a few years ago where classes were built differently, walls were, I guess, removed and spaces were differently constructed. So, for example, in our environments, we have sort of between, 80 to 100 kids with three teachers operating in spaces. However, open plan, depending on the type of build, whether it be refurbished, rebuild or brand new build, they're slightly different in each context.
In announcing the move away from open plan classrooms, Stanford said the reforms would be designed to improve student outcomes. With open plan classrooms, what are we seeing regarding student outcomes?
Yeah, when you consult with people that share a similar narrative, it's easy to, I guess, make broad brush statements around open plan classrooms. For myself, we're very fortunate to be purpose-built. We were built post-earthquake, so we've had no issues around things like acoustics because we've got acoustic panelling, and we've had no issues with the way in which the environment's delivering curriculum, because ultimately the focus for us is around how we drive pedagogical improvements, which is around how we deliver curriculum. So we still teach direct and explicit instruction as per some of the other initiatives that our minister has introduced in recent times, and we've been doing structured literacy for 5 years. So it's an interesting view on the environment, because for us the environment is secondary to the way in which we deliver curriculum.
Labour Party leader Chris Hipkins says the quality of teaching was more important than the design of classrooms. What is the correlation between a student's learning environment and the ability for effective teaching?
Yeah, I've been a principal for 12 years and I've taught and led schools both with single cell, I guess, environments as well as open plan environments, and I agree with the his statement around good teaching is good teaching, and the investment in my own staff in particular around their professional development and their understanding is far outweighs that the environment directly. We've got great staff who work together, they communicate together, and they're also supportive of each other because they're on show all the time. They're constantly teaching in front of each other, so therefore can feedback and provide, I guess, real-time conversations to support those who have got neurodivergent needs or they might have behaviour issues. So the real-time support, which I think is hugely important in regards to the way in which we deliver the support for teachers to do their job.
Hipkins also said that when he was Education Minister, he let schools decide on what decisions they were wanting to make. Should schools have more independence here regarding what works best for them?
Schools in New Zealand are self-governed, so every school is self-governed and works with the local ministry offices as well as government direction around how we implement things at the moment. For us, we will continue on in the same direction, so we'll make decisions for ourselves and in the best interest of our communities and the context we work in, because although we're a small country, the sort of broad brush across the whole thing is I don't think going to be very successful. We need to work based on our communities, and those who know our communities best are those who work in them day to day.
How tricky will the transition be for students who are accustomed to the learning style associated with open plan classrooms to moving to a different system?
It's an interesting question. For us, the change wouldn't actually be focused on the environment, so to speak. It'd be focused on the way in which we deliver curriculum. However, we don't intend to make any difference or changes to our physical environment. For others that are going from school to school, it's like anything. The way in which our teachers, they connect with each other, I think they would struggle moving to different environments because actually they enjoy working collaboratively with other staff. And the way in which the leadership of the school is delivering those professional development opportunities to ensure that collaboration is happening, whether they be in a single cell or an open plan learning environment. Kids in particular, I think, will adapt and I guess change to suit. However, the advantage of the open plan is that if it's one of my teachers is away sick or she's on release, or he's on release, I should say, then actually we've got other teachers they know very well because they have multiple people in the same space all the time. So that would be my concern around that.
Is there a difference to how open plan classrooms operate depending on whether the classroom design is in a primary, intermediate or secondary school?
It's really, again, context-based. For us, the primary school environment where I work, it works really well. But again, we've been purpose-built to suit the need. For others in secondary, I probably can't comment on that. I would put you towards some of my colleagues that work in that area on a daily basis. But we continue to have, our communities well supported. They really, do see the value in what we're doing. And I know Claire Amos up in Auckland is doing a fantastic job in an open plan secondary environment. So it's there's plenty of good talk and positive conversations around these environments in schools. And when it comes to the consultation process, I'm not aware that any of us were actually consulted to discuss this from a positive lens. So when you have a narrative, you always can find people to support that narrative if you choose to go that way.
The move coincides with the announcement that the government will move towards a new flexible design. What should we expect here?
Yeah, from what I've read, and I've read probably the same media announcements that everyone else has, is around that they'll have sort of glass sliding doors, so there'll be opportunities to open up spaces, which, again, working in both environments, I still believe Minister Hipkins's statement around good teaching is good teaching, and the most important resource that we have is that. So good teachers in those environments will still work really successfully. I'm not opposed to the flexibility of those spaces, but I haven't seen any designs yet. And it's probably more my concern about those who have the comments that are negative in regards to those who are currently operating different environments. For those moving forward with new builds, it will be what it will be. But for the rest of us, there's no mention of any kind of resourcing to retrofit. So for those who do choose or those who wish to manipulate their current environments, I'm not sure that the coffers will allow that to happen anyway.
That was the New Zealand Principals Federation, Blair Dravitsky, on the government's changes to open plan classrooms.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nā te mihi ki a koutou katoa e kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Carmel Cipollone, Electoral Reform Society UK's Ralph Hall, Auckland Council's Shane Henderson, and New Zealand Principal Federation's Blair Dravitsky. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia.
Breathing in.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.